Several years ago, I received funding from the NIJ to look at the effects of South Carolina's sex offender registration and notification policy on several outcomes. Those outcomes include primary prevention or general deterrence, recidivism, judicial decision-making, and then we've also looked at failure to register and recidivism, whether failure to register is associated with sexual or non-sexual recidivism. I don't have enough time to talk about that last study, but all of these studies have been published, and I give you a partial citation there. I'm happy to send the publications to anyone who cares to email me. I'm going to be talking about the first three of those four topics, and 20 minutes is not a lot of time to talk about three studies in. So I'm going to cut to the chase on these and not give you a lot of detail. Again, these are all published. The full citations will be listed, and I can send you the articles if you email me, or they're pretty easy to find online. And I think we're saving questions to the very end. So we have 30 full minutes for questions. So you will have time to ask your questions. We'll have time to answer them. But if you could save them to the last speaker, that would be great. South Carolina's SORN policy is very similar to the Sex Offender Registration Notification Act, the part of the Adam Walsh Act that legislates SORN policies nationwide. So in South Carolina, our policy is based solely on conviction offense. There's no risk assessment, which is similar to Adam Walsh Act. It includes a very wide range of offenses. There are almost no sex offenses in South Carolina that are not registry-eligible crimes. We require lifetime registration, which is misspelled. That's the only place where we actually are a little more severe than what is required by the Adam Walsh Act. And then we require online registration for all registrants over the age of 16 and several who are under that age as well. Given these similarities, it's my belief that the findings that we get from our research might forecast the effects of nationwide implementation of the Adam Walsh Act. The first study is that I'm going to talk about has to do with the effects of South Carolina's SORN policy on general deterrence or primary prevention of sex crimes. So the question we asked here and tried to answer is, did first-time sex crime arrests decline after SORN was implemented? And again, there's the citation for those of you that want to read the article. Using adult arrest data across a 16-year period of time, we modeled the effects of two intervention years, 1995, which is when South Carolina initially enacted SORN, and 1999, which is when online registration was enacted in our state. We looked at the rates of first-time sex crimes using ARIMA analyses, and then for comparison, first-time assault and robbery crimes, because if we saw a decline in sex crimes, but the decline was the same or occurred at roughly the same time as decline in other violent crimes, then that would not be attributable to SORN. But if we see a decline in sex crimes that corresponds with 1995 and or 1999, and we don't see that for other violent sex crimes, that supports a SORN-related hypothesis. We had quite a few arrestees, nearly 20,000 sex crimes, over 173,000 assault crimes, and 13,000 robbery crime arrests from these data. So these are population analyses for the state of South Carolina, not samples. What we found, which frankly was surprising to me, is that there were declines in first-time sex crime arrest rates following 1995 for sex crimes, but not for the other two types of crimes. This translated to about a 10 to 11% decline in first-time sex crime rates, or about three sex crimes averted per month following the initiation of SORN in South Carolina. We didn't see similar effects for assault and robbery, and we concluded that this supported a general deterrent effect or primary prevention effect for South Carolina's initial SORN policy. There was no similar effect for online registration, just for the original registration policy. These results replicate those of Prescott and Rockoff 2008, an unpublished but widely circulated study on multiple states' worth of data. They also found a deterrent effect. Sandler and Freeman in New York found no evidence of deterrence, and so our results are markedly different from theirs. And they used the exact same methodology, ARIMA analyses, across a 20-year period of time. We think that our differences are due to variation in state SORN policies. For example, South Carolina registers twice as many citizens as New York does. New York has a much more, has a risk-based SORN policy, and consequently they register fewer people. My working hypothesis right now is that when you register a lot of people for a wide variety of crimes, the message might actually get out to the general public. And I don't know if the message is, hey, this is a sex crime, you may not have known that, but now you do, or if the message is simply, don't do this because your face is going to, you're going to be on a registry at some point. What we need to do, however, is compare some state policies in the same study to find out if it's really policy variation that's driving the differences in the outcomes between our studies and, for example, those of the New York folks. Moving on to our second study. Here we looked at the relationship between South Carolina's SORN policy and recidivism. And we looked at, and we asked the question, did SORN reduce sexual recidivism, which is its main function? It's to reduce recidivism, right? And we also looked at other forms of recidivism. And again, there's the full reference. it's still in press, and I keep checking, and it's not out yet, but it should be soon, I'm sure. Again, we did population analyses. We took all men convicted of one or more sex crimes between a 15-year period of time. And at some point, a little over half were registered during follow-up. The mean follow-up time frame was 8.4 years with an average standard deviation of about 4 years. So basically, anywhere from 4 to 12 years we were following recidivism. We looked at new sex offense charges, and then separately we looked at new sex offense convictions, and we also looked at other violent offenses, any kind of person-related crimes, and nonviolent offenses. Regression analyses, we use regular standard Cox regression analyses, and we also use some comparative regression analyses where you can include all types of outcomes, but the results did not vary. In the models, we examined several covariates, including whether the offense was a registry-eligible offense, and then some demographic characteristics of offenders that we know influence recidivism: age at start at follow-up, offender race, number of prior convictions, and we looked at whether the victim of the index or the first sex crime was a minor or not. There were few new sexual charges across this average 8.4-year follow-up, only 8%. Registration status did not significantly predict sexual charges. Several other variables did, as predicted. There were even fewer new convictions, as we would expect, only 5%. And if that looks low to you, that number actually corresponds very closely with other research that's been done in South Carolina that was funded by the Bureau of Justice in a follow-up study to the three-year recidivism follow-up rate of all rapists and all child molesters. They found similarly low recidivism rates, as have recent reviews of national data. So when you're looking at people, not people who are referred for treatment, but if you're just looking at folks who have been arrested and convicted of sex crimes, their recidivism rates are low. And so that's actually not surprising. In any event, registration status was not a significant predictor of new sex crime convictions. All of the predictors in our model predicted violent recidivism except registration status, and the same with nonviolent offense charges. And so we concluded a couple of things. Sexual recidivism was a rare event, and SORN did not influence it. And SORN did not influence any other type of recidivism either. The folks in New York, Freeman and Sandler, Naomi Freeman and Jeffrey Sandler, also did not find that SORN influenced recidivism. They ran very similar analyses to ours. Other researchers have found conflicting results. Dewey and Dene, who are in Minnesota, found that the Minnesota notification process actually reduced recidivism. That process is a risk-based process that targets very high-risk offenders with the highest level of notification. They published a study in 2008, I think it was, where they found significant reductions in recidivism in relation to a comparison group of offenders who weren't subjected to notification. On the other hand, Prescott and Rockoff, who I just cited a moment ago, found increased recidivism rates for men who were subjected to notification. And so the results really vary widely. And again, I suspect strongly that that is due to differences in state policies. But again, there's been no research that has specifically compared different state policy characteristics to see if some characteristics are actually associated with increased recidivism, a criminogenic effect, whereas others might be associated with decreased recidivism, and others, like South Carolina's, are just plain ineffective at changing recidivism rates. Our third study looked at the effects of SORN on judicial decision-making. And specifically, we looked at whether the likelihood of pleading from a sex crime to a non-sex crime changed after SORN was implemented, and whether the likelihood of a final guilty determination changed after SORN was implemented. And again, we looked at two different time periods, 1995, time period 1995 to 98, which is when SORN was implemented, and 1999 to 2004, when online SORN was implemented. Again, these are population analyses with a very large number of defendants who have been charged with at least one sex crime in a 15-year period of time. And we included other covariates in the models, including whether the arrest was for a registry-eligible offense, whether the victim was a minor, offender age, race, number of priors, and whether the arrest was a no-parole offense. And that's a truth in sentencing designation, so if this was an offense that would get you some extra time per truth in sentencing laws, which were passed almost the same time as registration laws were passed in South Carolina. What we found is that the rate of pleading from a sex to a non-sex crime doubled over time. And so we went from about 10% of defendants pleading from a sex to a non-sex crime pre-SORN, so 1990 to 1994, before we had any SORN policy, to 20% after online registration was implemented. And those changes were all statistically significant. Variables that increased the likelihood of pleading included registry-eligible charge and having minority race. And then if you had a minor victim, or you were older at the time of your charge, you were less likely to be permitted to plead to a non-sex offense. But so here we see that SORN is actually doubled, responsible, I think, for doubling the rate of pleading. We did not see similar increases in pleading for other crime types. There are approximately 1,100 charges, sex crime charges, against adults per year in South Carolina. And that means we went from allowing 110 of those to plead to allowing 220 of those to plead. That's a lot of people who are being permitted to plead to a non-sex crime. And when they plead, pleas are almost universally associated with guilty determinations, of course. So you're being found guilty of aggravated assault and battery. That's almost all the offenses are pled to that particular crime, which means you will not get sex offender treatment, and you will avoid registration notification, which is the whole point of pleading in the first place, or it's a big part of it. So these folks are effectively opting out of any kind of treatment that might have been offered to them. Results for guilty dispositions were also interesting. 60% of all sex charge cases resulted in guilty dispositions, and the likelihood of getting a guilty finding increased after SORN was initially implemented, and then declined after online notification was implemented. And when we remove the pleaded cases, which you'll remember increased over time, and they are almost all associated with guilty determinations, when you take those out of the equation and you just look at people who were charged with a sex crime and adjudicated for a sex crime, the likelihood of them getting a guilty determination declined after online registration went into effect to below pre-SORN levels. So we started out at about 48% of these individuals being found guilty for a sex crime. That increased for a brief period of time after SORN was initially implemented, and then it declined below the pre-SORN levels to 45%. And although that doesn't seem like a big decline, 48% versus 45, it is statistically significant, and it indicates that after online notification, we actually had more people being acquitted. So we have more people pleading, a significant increase in pleading to non-sex offenses. If you don't plead, you're actually now much more likely to simply be acquitted outright. In combination, the results suggest that South Carolina's policy did achieve some modest effects in deterring new sex crimes, as I mentioned earlier, about 3 per month. But you have to look at that positive effect in light of the entire effect of this policy, I think. There's no effect on recidivism, which is what it was designed to reduce in the first place. And there are real significant changes in how these sex crime cases are handled. Many more are allowed to plead to non-sex crimes, and then significantly more now are simply not found guilty at all. We did not find similar changes, by the way, for other types of violent crimes, and so we did do our comparison analyses. As I mentioned, sex offenders convicted of non-sex crimes are going to not receive specialized treatment. They avoid registration and the notification altogether. Exonerated sex offenders are going to avoid any kind of judicial consequences. And potentially the effects of that are that they may not view their actions as having been particularly detrimental. We also know that victims are hurt when offenders are not held accountable. There's a long history of research in that area. South Carolina's public registration policy relies entirely on the conviction offense. There's no risk assessment. It targets a very broad category of offenders. There are people who are on our lifetime online registry for voyeurism and for indecent exposure, as well as for much more serious sex crimes. But because our policy is so broad, it overwhelmingly targets low-risk offenders. And I think that the results from our research suggest two policy modifications. I think there's a strong argument to be made for reserving registration and particularly for reserving notification for high-risk offenders. These are costly interventions. We're starting to look into the costs. My colleagues, actually all of the colleagues here, Kristen and Elisa and some others are starting to look into the costs of registration and notification, and it's really quite astronomical. Not to mention, when you have so many offenders on the registry, it, I think, does the community a disservice. I'm not sure what you would do to protect yourself from someone who is an indecent exposure versus someone who is a child molester with repeated victims. When you treat those two people the same, I think it makes it difficult for the community to use these tools in any meaningful way. I think online notification, in particular when there's no discretion, there's no judicial discretion, there's no risk assessment, we see some very significant changes in case processing. And these changes were completely unanticipated. Nobody expected more sex offenders to be let go. And nobody expected more sex offenders to be permitted to plead to non-sex offense crimes. Those are some effects of South Carolina's policy, and I suspect those will be the effects of Adam Walsh Act when it's implemented nationwide, because the two policies share so many characteristics. And so I think the second policy recommendation is that online notification should be curtailed significantly, if not eliminated, but certainly curtailed. In several cases, our results conflicted with other researchers, and as I've said, I think that policy characteristics probably account for those changes. New York registers relatively few offenders compared to South Carolina. That might account for their differences in general deterrence. They found no effect. We did find a general deterrent effect. But both states found no evidence of reductions in recidivism. On the other hand, Minnesota, which has a different tiered and risk-based policy, did find reductions in recidivism. Prescott and Rockoff, using national data, found increases in recidivism. We really have to move beyond single-state studies. And this is a note that I've been sounding for the last couple of years. We have got to have some comparison studies that take data from several states that you, not just aggregate data, you really need individual level data so you can follow, you can identify offender characteristics and specific offender recidivism and see how those are influenced by policy characteristics such as whether registration is conviction-based or risk-based, whether duration is 10 years or life, whether notification involves online notification or some much more targeted notification or no notification. I think those are the three main areas of variation across state policies that probably are having influences on these outcomes, in particular the outcomes in judicial decision making. I believe that when judicial actors perceive that they have judicial decision, that they have some control over what happens, that you wouldn't see the reductions, or the increases in plea bargains or the reductions in guilty determinations that you see in our state when judicial actors have zero control over the process. And that's the end of my talk. Thank you very much for your time.